Hello, welcome to episode 24 of the Two Guys, Three Consoles podcast.
My name is Matt Leach, also known as the Leach Man.
Big spoiler warning, this is a Clair Obscur Expedition 33 spoiler cast. So this is your massive spoiler warning. We're going to spoil the game. We're going to spoil it a lot. So that's that introduction. But let's introduce who's on the podcast with us today. So as usual, my co-host is here, Jeremy J. Monster Fowler. How are you doing, Jeremy?
Hello, I'm good, thanks. All right.
Good. And we've got some special guests on. Our very first special guest is one you may have heard before, the dulcet tones of Man from Wales.
And it's Kyle Disco Breather Brown.
How are you doing, Kyle?
Yeah, really good, Matt. I'm trying slowly not to melt into the ground with the obscene weather down south. I know it's different up there for you northerners, but...
Yes, we're in the frozen north.
Yeah, it's getting toasty down here at the moment, so yeah. But other than that, no, doing well, man, doing well.
Excellent, excellent. And a very special guest, you've heard him before. It's the host of the So Video Games podcast and editor of GameCritics.com. It's Brad Galloway.
Hey, good to be back, guys. Hello.
Hey, how are you doing?
Excellent, excellent. I am also melting here in the Pacific Northwest of the United States. It is. I'm literally sitting in a puddle of my own flesh right now. From the top, I can podcast. From the bottom, it's a horrific mess.
How many degrees Fahrenheit is it? Because I know you use Fahrenheit over there.
Oh, it's like 85, which I'm not sure what that converts into. Something like 3,000 or whatever on your scale. I don't know how that goes, but it's really hot.
28, yeah. I think. Yeah, sounds about right.
That works. That's a mystery to me. I'll trust you. Yeah.
So the format of this podcast is we're going to talk about the game, and to start off with, it's like how each one of us found out about this game and what made us kind of want to play it. So I'll probably start with Brad on this one. What attracted you to this game, Brad?
Well, you know, I saw the trailer during one of the Xbox showcases. I want to say it was like the year before, or at least 6 months before. And I thought, oh, you know, it looks okay. I only play one or two RPGs a year, and that one seems kind of interesting. Dark, kind of like some of the imagery in the trailer, but I didn't think too much of it. And then as soon as the game dropped, it was just like everybody in my circle was like going on and on and on. I'm like, oh shit, okay, you know, I was going to get to it, but it was like a priority. But you know, once that zeitgeist hits, you got to get in on it. Just everybody's talking about it and excited about it, so I just downloaded and jumped in as soon as I felt like it was on fire.
Excellent. How about you, Kyle? How did you find out about this game?
I was super late into it. Because for me, I sort of like heard rumblings throughout, just a kind of general, if you're online, you see videos and general talk about it. But I knew from the start it was a turn-based RPG. And I am not a turn-based person at all. It's not my bag whatsoever. So it wasn't necessarily on my radar. Probably like 2 or 3 weeks after, some of the major streamers, everyone was kind of like, as Brad mentioned, everyone was playing it. It was everywhere. And quite a prolific streamer called Co. The guy I watch occasionally, he started a playthrough of it right in the beginning, and I watched him play the beginning, and I was like, actually, you know what, there's something about this. And then my wife kind of creeped in the background while I was watching and goes, I think you'd like that. And I was like, it's turn-based, I don't like it. And then one thing led to another, and she basically bought the game for me as a gift. They go, you need something, give it a go, I think you'll like it, kind of thing. And it just went from there, and it turned into one of my favorite games of the last like 10 years.
Yeah, that's interesting. How about you, Jeremy? How did you find out about this game?
So I was trying my best to ignore it because it's turn-based. And then so many people were telling me to play it, Kyle being one of them. And I was like, don't want to play turn-based, don't want to play it. And I kind of like was like, manana, and put it off for like, what, a month before I finally caved. And Carl gave me some good advice. It was like, just stick it on easy, which is where I stayed for my entire playthrough, by the way. From time to time, when I was getting a bit more confident, I was trying to take it back onto normal. And then after getting my butt handed to me, I was back onto easy again.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
I mean, but I did it on Game Pass.
On Game Pass, yeah. Well, I actually, from a friend, had a copy on PS5, even though it wasn't Game Pass. So I decided to play it on PS5 because they lent me their copy. And it was just word of mouth, really, that I heard about this game, like you guys talking about it. And I saw, I saw some YouTube videos about the music of it. And I watched a couple of these videos about the music. And I was like, that sounds good. And I played quite a few turn-based games, Persona being the most Brad knows about Persona games.
Oh yeah.
And I played a few, and so I was like, you know, turn based, that's fine with me. So that's how I heard about it. Really, was just word of mouth, and I started playing it, and it's like, yeah, I really. It did take me a few hours to get into it because it's very French. Very French.
That's an understatement.
Like, it's a very French game, and it's like, it's kind of, you've got to just immerse yourself in the kind of culture around the development of this game as mm-hmm. as you're playing it. But yeah, just word of mouth for me, really. So I think we'll maybe get the big topic out of the way, really, which is the story,
right?
So I'll start, and then you guys can just jump in when you feel like it. The main premise of the story is that you are getting ready to basically go on an expedition.
Yeah.
There's this big monolith in the middle of the sea. I think it's a sea, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Yeah.
There's 33 on it, and through various conversations of the characters, you figure out that this is not the first expedition to basically go out and find out why people are just evaporating into flowers or petals or whatever.
It's the gommage.
The gommage, yes. Which basically,
they don't really tell you what the gommage is to start with.
No.
I was very confused at the very start of this game, I must say.
Yeah, all you find out is anyone who's at that age or above, basically, there's something called the gommage, which is basically just people just disappear or quote-unquote die. That's the beginning part of it. I was a bit confused, but I think you're supposed to be confused until the characters give you some exposition of what's going on. But it's broken up into how many chapters? I can't fucking remember now.
Three acts in total.
That's right. Yeah,
and you start. The interesting thing with that entry is the way in which you introduce characters and just like. It showed you the world that it had built already. Like you weren't starting from the beginning. You were starting from something that was very well established. Didn't really give much, like I said, not much exposition whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're just thrown in. And there's the kind of a little bit of exposition as you're wandering through. And I like the fact you can kind of do some exploring. And it seemed the way it set up was a weird vibe because it was almost celebratory in certain aspects of like you went to town square and you spoke to people. Mm-hmm. And there was always this underpinning of just sadness and melancholy, despite there being like people dancing and painting and celebrating. And it was always that melancholy. And you didn't know why. It was like, oh, cool. Yeah. It's a big celebration. There's flowers everywhere.
Yeah.
And then as it progressed, it kind of hit that big, that turn point in the story when everyone just went poof and Thanos basically and turned into flowers.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, Jesus Christ, where did that come from? But everyone seemed like, not okay with it, but just at terms with it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it just seemed to handle like the notion of death quite well in that beginning. It's like, people just accept it at this point. And then as you go through, as we will discuss later, it's part and parcel of it. And they just knew it was coming. So they've just come to accept it and they just celebrate it where they did. And I thought that's a really interesting way to introduce the world and mm-hmm. set the tone. It really did a really good job of setting the tone of what you were stepping into going into the rest of the game.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit of a side, but did anyone find the video, the window with the people fucking?
No, I did not find that.
No. It's so good. Like, you can go and stand outside the window and you can hear them through the window. And then eventually they stop and they're like, look, it was exciting to start with, but it's getting creepy now. Fuck off. And they give you like a Lumina thing to go away.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, that's amazing. No, I did not find it. I wish I had found that. I did not find
it. Yeah, it's really funny.
and the guy in the bin. Did you find the guy in the bin?
I didn't find him, no.
There's a dude in the bin and you find out he's been hiding there all year in the hopes of escaping the gommage from the paintress. So he thought by hiding in the bin...
Right.
And the really interesting about this is like, because you can interact with everything in there, and it just gives you really inconsequential descriptors of what you're interacting with.
Yeah.
And then all the bins have the same line every time you do it, apart from this one. And if you then engage with it again and then do it a third time, the guy's like, go away, they're going to find me. And then you start to find out that this guy's in the bin trying to hide from the gommage. And I think it gives you, like, I don't know, it gives you something, some currency, something to kind of go away from it. But it does. Swoop back around as well to that bin as you kind of go full circle as part of the story progresses, but you do come back in and you can find that same bin later on and you find another thing in there.
Right.
There's like a Pictos in there from where the guy was like, he didn't escape. No bin's going to hide you from the
Pinterest. No, that's funny. That's funny. Clever they did that.
Yeah. Mm.
It's clever. I mean, I completely missed those things. I didn't even look for them, to be honest.
I mean, to be honest, the only reason I found the window with the people fucking is I saw it in a video and I wanted to go and hear it for myself in the game.
Right, okay.
I like that beginning a lot, but I got to say, I mean, I think it's really well paced, but for me, I don't know how you guys feel, but like at that point when I was starting the game, I was not invested yet. I didn't know if I was going to like this game or not. And so until I am really invested in a game, I don't usually click on everything and talk to all the people and get all the dialogue. It felt like kind of like I wanted to kind of just go through and kind of let the experience kind of wash over me to see if it was going to connect. But there was like a lot of stuff there that you could have done. You could have fought like the mime, and I didn't know about the bin guy. I didn't know the people having sex in the window. There's probably other stuff too that you could click on, but I kind of missed it because I was like, well, let me just get the vibe before I start being like, you know, micromanaging all these interactions and stuff. And then one, of course, you know, once the game starts, it's too late to go back. Well, I'm like, well, fuck, I, you know, now that I'm in the right mood, I would like to go back and click on a few more things, but I didn't. So I guess whatever. Yeah. I'll just have to live on my entire life knowing that I missed those things, but you know, it's fine.
Yeah, okay, I mean, on the subject of missing stuff is really interesting because, like, as just after that cutscene where it gives you the big reveal of the Paintress and the Gommage, you can, there's like vendors you can get coins from.
Yeah.
That you can spend them on the vendors.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, if you don't spend all the coins and keep one on you, if you load into New Game Plus, as you start that introduction, there's a boulangerie just as you find Sophie. And you can get a baguette, which you can use as a weapon in game. But it's like there's nothing it tells you about that at all. Because again, you've got to, again, Brad was saying, you just play the game as you would do. So you wouldn't think to keep one of these little coins on you. But if someone obviously had done and played through it again and got this baguette as a weapon. It's a nice little Easter egg on the New Game Plus stuff, which is quite cool.
It's also a Final Fantasy maneuver. That's pretty cheap. That kind of makes me mad.
It's nice to know that you can actually, because it is so French, you can use a baguette as an actual weapon. That's quite funny.
Yeah, but it also doesn't tell you that when you get to the bakery, if you press the wrong button and don't press the accept baguette button, you don't get it, and then you don't get a second chance. You just lost it.
Yeah.
But then again, why would you turn down a baguette? Like, you should always accept a baguette, right?
Well, having lived in France for about a month, I can attest to baguettes only last less than a day in France because they are like literal sticks after a day.
All right.
You're supposed to eat them within like a couple of hours when they're baked. Otherwise, they just like turn to stone. So no wonder it could be used as a recipe.
Stale baguettes.
Yeah. But I mean, so its introduction was pretty like say, Brad, like just wanted to wash over you and get into the mood of the game, and then it kind of moves on into Act One proper, and I'm struggling to remember what kind of the first big encounter is really.
It's the beach map. So when you're, it's basically a cutscene effectively. So it has you sailing across the sea towards the Paintress.
Yeah,
and then it's when you first land. On the other end, basically, where I think Lune, one of the characters, had pinpointed the exact location for Expedition Zero.
Mm-hmm.
So they thought they're going to follow that track, because Expedition Zero is the one that came back, one of the only expeditions that ever came back from any expedition gone. And then it hit that big, hard-hitting cutscene where it introduces a mysterious character, and essentially almost everyone dies. Mm. and at that point, you've had some tutorial-y type fights. We still haven't fought anything. And then, everyone's dead. You know, okay, where's this going to go now? And then it throws you into playing Gustav initially. Yeah. And you're kind of like then exploring the world. And you're on your own at that point. You just have one character as you explore him.
Yeah. And I liked the Gustav character quite a lot when, you know, you can kind of identify with him, you know, and what he's going through and making his way through the game. And then a few hours in, I can't even remember if it's before the end of Act 1 or the beginning of Act 2, the main boss of the game. And
Renoir.
Yeah, and he fucking kills Gustav. And I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah, it's the end of Act 1. So just a little bit on Gustav. Charlie Cox, who was Daredevil, was the voice of Gustav. And apparently he didn't really know what he was in for. His agent just told him to turn up at this point, and you're doing some voice acting. And apparently he did all of his voice lines for the entire game in 4 hours and then went home.
Wow. That was a good payday for him.
It's just pretty impressive, because it's not like he phoned it in. He did a good job.
No, it was great. Yeah, it was great. Just to go back a little bit to that cutscene, that whole everybody dying left and right and people getting cut in half and blood. I mean, that was like a crazy cutscene, and I was not ready for that. So that was a really impactful way to start the game. But just I want to ask you guys, so at this point, we didn't really know what the story of the game was or what even was really going on. And so when Renoir shows up, I don't mean to sound racist at all, but I was like, is he just an older version of Gustav, or do all Frenchmen look alike? Like, I'm not sure what's going on here. And I was like, wait, is it going to be a time travel story? What's happening? And I was like, is it not? Is it not him? I can't tell. I don't know.
Yeah, it was kind of cryptic. I think purposely so. When you commit, like, you're meant to like kind of second guess yourself and think, who is this character? Is it
what's the line from the past, future?
Hey,
he's got this line about this. You might not realize this yet, but this is a kindness as he kills.
Yeah.
And I was like, huh? Didn't understand that at all. Like, even having finished the game, that line still went over my head.
Hey, when you finished the game,
yeah.
You know, I have got answers that I do know why he says that line, and it makes sense. But you've got to basically, when you finish it, you've got to unpack everything. And there's a lot of stuff which will kind of cover the way in which it tells the story, and it's that element of discovery. It does spoon feed you some, and you can progress quite steadily through it. But it also, if you are the kind of person to venture from the beaten path and sort of like to explore and go different areas, it does reward you with a fair amount of exposition from things like the journals and things introduced in.
I
like that it caters for, if you just want the story and you just want to be given everything, you can kind of get a fair interpretation of what it's trying to sell you. But if you're someone who's, if once you get to the point where you're invested, think, I want more of this, and you start exploring the world, which will, again, we'll cover the overworld, I think, as well as part of the discussion. This exploration does get rewarded. It gives you lots of little logs and it takes you places to see things, and that makes sense of that, and that's weird, that didn't make sense, what does that mean? And then you find something else a bit later, and it all kind of starts to click together. I think this is one of the few games I kind of played through, I didn't need to go straight to YouTube and say, what does this mean? Somebody info dumped this for me, somebody explained to me what I've just watched. I was able to kind of like get a lot from it, enough to go, okay, well, I know what that means. So I feel comfortable in my interpretation of what I've just played, which I think is a strength of Sandfall in their storytelling, at least from my perspective anyway, that I was able to do that. And I didn't feel the need to have to go and explore to figure out what they were trying to get across.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I totally agree. And in fact, I'm not usually the secret finder. I don't read all the lore descriptions and stuff. I usually just like to play the game straightforward and just whatever happens, happens. I found maybe like, I don't know, a quarter or maybe a third of all the logs you could possibly find. So I got some flavor, but not all. And I think that I agree with you, Kyle, that it is a credit to Sandfall that it all came together. It didn't come together for me until like almost the very end. And at that point, like, I was still like, I'm not 100% sure what was happening. I know some things that I think I kind of know, some things I don't, but it really did come together at the end. And I wasn't sure that it was going to. And in fact, I waited until I had finished the game all the way before I recommend this to my wife, because my wife loves French things. But I'm like, she's going to hate it if the story doesn't come together. I got to see what's going on first. And I'm like, okay, it came together. I have some questions, and there's some things that are hazy and some things that I think maybe don't quite line up. But like the large sense of everything, like, really kind of fit together nicely. So I'm like, okay, kudos to that, because I was really not sure until like the 11th hour that it was going to satisfy. But I really did feel satisfied by the time we found everything out.
So you mentioned the introduction. Land on the boat, get cutscenes out of control, Gustav, and then the introduction of the party to the very first person we find. And it might be interesting to discuss the circumstance under which this party member was kind of discovered, was when Gustav's character had almost completely changed. Because you see him in the Gommage and go through it, and the touching moment with Sophie and his interactions with the expedition. And the next thing you see him after the entire expedition has been completely slaughtered on the beach by Renoir. And then he's progressing, and the next thing you know, he discovers that almost like cave under like a base of a tree. just full of corpses, just full of corpses of like
literally piled with corpses, isn't it?
Yeah. And he basically, you just see him sit there and he materializes a gun and he's about to end his own life. Yeah,
suicidal.
Yeah. And to see that, I mean, again, that makes sense. Like you would expect somebody who's had that much of trauma immediately to kind of go, what is going on? I can't do this.
Mm.
And then it was an introduction to Lune, and then they were a good rejuxtaposition because they had a discussion about like honor to the expedition, and one of them just wanted to find, like, Gustav was all about Maya, another character I haven't talked about yet.
Mm-hmm.
And Lune was very much this stoic, no, we've got a mission, we are the expedition team here, it's all about those that come after, and we've got to sort of do the most for them. And it's that sort of cross and that development of that, at least that relationship with Gustav and Lune.
Yeah,
and then it rolls on from there. Then,
yeah.
And then trying to think what order is in. I think, do you get Mael next in the manor?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So she's third, and then who's your fourth party member of your original team?
It's the one where you have to go to the the arena, don't you? And you have to fight all those different enemies,
or whatever they're called.
Yeah,
Destrals. How can you not remember? Destrals,
sorry, are called. Yes.
Gestalt. It is. And I think, I mean, one thing to talk about, because we're kind of at that stage where it does introduce it, is the overworld.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you travel and traverse the world in this is like very much, I'm not a big Final Fantasy person or JRPG person, but I've understood that way of doing it is kind of an old schooly kind of JRPG way of doing it. You've got a bit more about this. I don't know.
Yeah, the traversal of the world very much reminded me of Ni No Kuni. That's what it reminded me of, which is another turn-based RPG, a very good one, but it's fucking long, that game.
Mr. Drippy.
Yeah, the traversal of the world is very similar, and it does it in a few Japanese RPGs like that, where you get an overworld and you can have random battles, you know. But yeah, that is atypical of that kind of RPG.
I say this, I'm not an RPG. I've only ever played to finish Final Fantasy VIII, and that's the only one I've ever done.
Oh, wow.
But I am thankful that they didn't introduce random battles in that overworld. We're just wandering, and all of a sudden something will just attack you. So pleased that wasn't a thing.
That's why I never finished Final Fantasy VII, the original one, because I'd never got past Midgard, because running up and down that fucking staircase, every 2 seconds there was a random battle, and I'm like, I'm done with this. Yeah. But I wasn't only like 24 at the time.
So the main overworld's got a map, and we need to touch on this a little bit, just because me and my sense of direction or lack thereof, there is no mini map in this game, which was my biggest bugbear about the entire game. And when I brought it up with Kyle, he's like, it's all right, it's really linear. And I think generally that is the thing. But can't deny, there's also some areas in this game I got so fucking lost and kept coming back on myself over and over again. I was like, God damn it.
I was fine until about 3/4 into the game. And then there was one area, I think it's where you have to go and fight the faces.
The visage. Visage,
yeah, the angry face, the happy face, the sad face.
No, that's right, he's one of the Axons,
completely lost. Up until that point, I didn't have a problem, but it could have done with a mini map, really. I'd agree.
Yeah,
there was a little bit of that I kind of agree with, because I went back to do the platinum trophy on it, which meant going through on a second playthrough and re-exploring a lot of the areas in the beginning again.
Yeah,
and for the most part, I found like I kind of remembered where things were, and I knew where things were. But certainly when you're looking for specific things, like Pictos for one, I just trying to max out and find all the Pictos just to make builds and things.
Yeah.
That one area that's like, I can't remember what it's called now, but it's like almost semi-underground, underwater. So it's that underwater theme. That's confusing. Because a lot of times I got turned around looking for certain crevices and stuff in there. And I just think, you're absolutely right, Jeremy. If there was a mini-map for that kind of traversal, it would at least guide you a little bit better. You can kind of go, have I been turned around? I don't know. And you've got no reference point, really, until you kind of realize you've gone back on yourself. Oh, I recognize this archway. Right, okay, then go back again. I think on occasions, there are some things that would have benefited from a mini-map. Definitely while it was like in the locations. The overall, maybe not so much, but definitely in the locations did need something.
Yeah,
quite clever was every so often you come across an area and you just see like a wooden door, and you think, what the fuck's that doing there? And you walk in the wooden door and you're back in the mansion. I was like, and having completed the game, I thought that was quite clever. Like, you can go back to the mansion in certain areas, and there's like, we'll get to it, but you know, because of what it is, it's a painting. It kind of launches, you know, it's kind of a circular thing. It goes back to where you were before. I thought that was clever, because first time I come across, like, why am I going back to the mansion? But it makes sense once you've completed it.
I will say, though, I thought it was weird. I mean, a couple things. Number one, I thought they were going to use the mansion as kind of like a hub, and that maybe you would use that to go between the areas, but they didn't actually really do that ever at all. Like, you kind of went through the different rooms to unlock it. So that kind of caught me by surprise. An interesting choice. I mean, it surprised my expectations, but whatever. But getting back to the level design, you know, we talked about this quite a bit, me and some friends, and in various Discords and stuff. And it was a pretty common theme that the developers intentionally did not put in a minimap, because they didn't want you to look at the minimap all the time. They wanted you to absorb and be lost in all of the beautiful landscapes and stuff. And they're great landscapes, but I mean, I think I'm like Jeremy, my internal mental compass must be broken or something, because I would walk into a level, I'd fight one battle, and then I would progress, and then I would come back, and I think I get to the end of the level. I'm like, oh, actually, no, I'm at the start of the level again.
Yeah.
I simply just immediately walked back to where I was, and I didn't realize it. That happened
all the time.
And then there'd often be places where I'm like, well, I really want to explore every crevice of this, and did I go this way? It looks just like this other way. And if you took like all the graphics out of it, I'm sure it'd be pretty simple. If you could just look at the wireframe of the level, it would be like a hallway with a couple branchings, and almost all the levels kind of follow that same template, like, which I get, but all the decoration, it's so hard to tell. And then the level where you're fighting the dancing lady, the other Axon, I forget what her name was, the one who's like spinning or dancing or whatever. There's like everything's yellow and brown sand. There's tons of like sheets all over the place, and everything looks the same. And I'm like, oh my god, like I'm like in circles so many times. So I get why the developers didn't want to have a minimap, but I think also that's a bit of hubris on their part, because there are many people's brains who work differently, and clearly Jeremy's compass and my mental compass don't work at all. I needed help to get through these levels, and I get that it's beautiful, but also you got to make accommodations for people who just need that wayfinding, or make it optional. You know, do you want minimap? Yes or no? In the menu? That's no problem. But man, I got, that was my biggest thing too. So lost all the time.
I think there was one level where I thought was quite, it's very subtle in some of the levels, but in this one, I found it quite in your face. There's lanterns that you have to follow. And if you just follow the lanterns in like a, it takes you through the level, which was a good level design. But like you say, some of that level that you mentioned with the dancing lady, I'm like, where the fuck am I? Like, there's lifts everywhere that go down to this level. And this is a dead end. And that's a dead end. It's like, come on, you got to give us a little bit to go on here. I know it's subtle clues as where to go next, but come on.
Those lanterns were too subtle. Somebody told me about that. Like hours after I had been lost, and I was like, oh, really? I thought that was just like background set dressing or something. Yeah. It didn't even occur to me that those lanterns meant anything. So maybe I'm dense, I don't know, but that was a little too subtle for me. I like a big red arrow is what works for me.
That's exactly where I am. Any game that like basically leads me by the hands to where to go, like in Bioshock with a big fuck off arrow, or Xenoblade X has got like a little ball thing that you shoot forward and it leaves a trail behind it.
Yeah, the breadcrumb trail. Anything.
All that shit. Yeah. I'm well on for that. Give me that.
Dead Space, you just click the stick in and it showed you a little line that you needed to follow.
Yeah, for sure.
we've got the overworld map that you should traverse, and then the progression of the story. I think the one thing with the story for me is it. I will admit I didn't see all the twists and turns that come with it.
No.
Maybe some intellectual on Reddit probably did, and I'll be extolled for not figuring it out. But like the way Act One, which we've alluded to already, like the way an Act One ends, where you'd have been invested, you've got to know Ghost Star, you've got to build the party up, you've found Luna, you've found Sia, you've got Mael. You then have this confrontation with like one of the Lantern boss, who's like a big boss fight.
Yeah.
And then that goes straight into what you think is done, and all of a sudden, this mysterious like character who we now know in hindsight as Renoir turns up, and it starts to play out a certain way, and you go, "Nah, they're not. No, they wouldn't. No, it's something. SGA is going to come to the rescue here. There's someone else you'll mention. Yeah. We can talk about in a bit. We have to talk about SGA.
Yes.
But he'll come along and he'll rescue him. It'll be fine. Mile will break out. And all of a sudden, it's like, poof, bang, guillotine, straight away. Gustav dies. He gets killed off. And it's like, okay, where is this going now? What's happening next?
Yeah, it was brilliant stuff. I love Gustav. And that was like, you know, obviously like the Eris moment, you know, like once a generation when everybody who plays that game is just like gutted in the same way, you know.
Yeah.
So cool. I mean, it was fair play to them. I thought it was quite good. Although I was disappointed because I like Gustav a lot. And, you know, I'm sure we're going to talk about it, but I don't like Verso nearly as much.
Well, I'm saying.
I'm like, I want Gustav back, dude. This is balls, yeah, man. But like, anyway, yeah, I mean.
You warmed to Verso. I didn't warm to Verso, even by the end, which is why, and I'm sure we'll get to that bit about the choice at the end. I did not choose Verso at the end because I never warmed to him.
Yeah, I didn't either. It was weird to me. Well, okay, so let me ask you guys this. So I understand why they killed Gustav, and it makes sense. And, you know, whatever. I have a soft spot for the guy. Whatever, it's fine. Mm-hmm. But it seemed to me in the course of the story that after Gustav dies and everybody's kind of in the aftermath, like Verso shows up like almost immediately, and it felt too soon to like have another bearded Frenchman show up again, who kind of looked like Gustav, but not really. I was like, is this alternate Gustav? And Renoir was future Gustav? Like they all kind of like all this template. It just felt too soon. And then the way that the party kind of like deferred to him, for me, like after Gustav died, like Lune kind of took over mentally. I was using her to like walk around the world, and so I would look at her most of the time. And then she was kind of like the voice of authority in my mind anyway, after Gustav died, like the second in command or something.
Yeah.
And then Verso shows up, and then like you play as him, and when you're in the camp and stuff, and I'm like, why am I this guy? He's just this rando who shows up. He's not part of the expedition. I don't even know who he is. Why am I controlling him? And a lot of like the meta elements of like you controlling him in the camp and like some of the things that you do in the dialogues, you play Verso. And I'm like, I don't even want to be Verso. Why am I Verso? And that part never worked for me. I know why they did it. I guess that was a choice. They could have done something different. But for me, I would have liked to choose somebody else, play from a different perspective. But Verso and me never got along. And it just felt weird that he all of a sudden was like, I am now as the player Verso. And it just never worked for me.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't really give you, they give you some time, but they don't give you a lot of time to sort of grieve Gustav, really.
Not it's like, much, literally, no.
The man is dead. He's definitely gone. Like, do you want to carry on playing? Yes, I'll carry on playing. and then, like you say, Verso comes along. But I'm kind of in between you guys and Kyle in regards to Verso. I didn't really like him at first, but once I understood who he was, and his motivations, I kind of warmed to him a bit more. You know, I kind of liked the complexities that he had in his personality, because he's obviously a very conflicted person. Well, to not a person, but I thought it was a good change of kind of what's the word I'm looking for? A good change of personality. You know, Gustav, although he was quite jovial at first, was very stoic once all those bodies happened, you know, all that killing, he was very stoic. And then, you know, he was on for the mission and he's on for it. And then bang, he's dead. And then Verso's like, yeah, well, he's dead. We've got to move on. I was like, what? You know what I mean? But as the game progressed, I did warm to him a bit more, I must admit. He wasn't your favorite character, was he, Kyle?
Kind of was.
Yossi.
Not my favorite character. Not my favorite character, but I feel as if I probably did warm to him a lot better than you guys did. And I think the points that Brad made, 100% valid to begin with. Mm. It's a very jarring juxtaposition to go from Gustav, who they put a lot of effort in to gain you on side with. You know, they reveal a lot about him, a lot of personality, a lot of character development in just that short space in the first act you play with him. And then to kind of go from that to now this random bearded French dude that is also now in the mix out of nowhere with no explanation. And everyone just seems to kind of be like, oh, okay, fine. And then you're just playing as him. I think I'm not sure why, but I think I did quite like his, like say, the complexity that was Reverso. And I think what really warmed me to him is when they introduced SGA.
Right.
In comparison to Verso, you had those like playoffs with Verso and SGA because they were clearly friends.
They knew each other.
Yeah, yeah, it starts to reveal a bit more about, okay, well, Verso is clearly part of this outer island away from Lumiere. A lot going on. Why is he still young? He's like part of Expedition Zero, and it's a lot. It leaves a lot of questions, but it doesn't push you down to the answers. It sort of like makes, again, we'll talk about, I think, the character development relationship thing that you can do within the camps, and you can build relationships with each character. And there is a gameplay benefit to doing that, not necessarily just a character building element to it. But sometimes it's almost disingenuous a bit. It's like your arm is forced to play as Verso, this stranger, when there was such a close-knit group prior to Gustav being killed off. And I agree. I didn't like that at first, but I think as I went on and I started to learn more about the family and who Verso was and what was going on with, again, multiple versions of each person. One was a painting, one was not, and where we were, I did start to warm to him a bit. And like at the end, which we'll talk about, I think the ending is a choice that we'll go into, I imagine. There was no question in my mind about which one I was going to make because of how I'd grown to appreciate Verso as a character and liked playing him. Like towards the end, I was very much like using him as my main party, like for a damage dealer. And he was one of the makeup of the four that I was continually using when I got towards the end of it. So for me, there's a lot of like, I wasn't there for the start, but I definitely warmed as the story went through quite a lot.
I mean, Verso, as well as knowing SK, knows, was it Monaco or his name is?
Monaco. Yeah, he knows Monaco as well, yeah. Which we need to talk about Monaco as well as SK.
Yeah. So he's got some history there with a few of the characters that you pick up along the way.
Well, I think it's probably a good point now in regards to the story to kind of like allude to what we were saying with where we were and what was going on. Because I think as you go through sort of Act 2, which, think about that, how did everybody find the length of Act 2 in comparison to what we've been playing so far?
Game feels a little bit top-heavy because Act 3 is so short.
Well, at least you got to the end of Act 2. I mean, because I thought Act 1 was like the perfect kind of length in gameplay-wise, and then Act 2 seemed to go on a little bit too long, but like you say, it's bookended by a very short Act 3. Because, like, when you get to the end of Act 2, you think, is this the end of the game? Can't be the end of the game. It's not. Yeah. But it kind of makes you think it is. I thought the last, like, quarter of Act 2, I found a bit of a slog to get through. I'm not going to lie.
Getting to the top of the monolith.
It was a real slog to get through that. Maybe, and I don't think I was under leveled that much, but I was at a level where I could still defeat enemies. Like Jeremy said at the beginning of the discussion, I started off on normal for the first 5 hours, I think, and then I kicked it down to easy because it was just too fucking hard. I was getting my ass kicked all the time. But for
they patched it as well at some point as well, didn't they?
The what?
They patched it.
They did patch it, which I did notice a difference in the parry timing when they patched it. I did notice that. So it'd make easy mode even a little bit easier. But I'd never went back to normal mode, so I couldn't compare it to that. But I think Act 2 could have been to do with a little bit shorter, and maybe they could have expanded Act 3, because you get an epilogue as well, don't you? I found Act 2 the last quarter of it a bit of a slog.
I thought it was okay. I mean, I was really contrasting it pretty hardly with Act 3, and I have some issues with Act 3, like, in general. Maybe we can talk about, like, how the developers decided to make the required portion of it so small, but then they left so much optional stuff for the end of Act 3. And I don't know about you guys, but I was kind of just playing. I wasn't really, like, digging for secrets or anything like that. And because there was no map or no quest log, no way to, like, leave markers where you found something that you want to come back to, by the time I got to that part of Act 3, I was like, well, I know there's stuff to do, but, like, I would walk into an area where I was underleveled and I would get, like, steamrolled. I'm like, okay, well, this is not the right place. Where was that place that I saw the treasure chest a while ago? Or where was that one boss that, oh, I've got the gear that I can beat him now? And where was that? I don't remember where that was. And I just, at that point in the game, because of how the story was rolling forward, I was ready to kind of, like, end it. But then they're like, hold on, here's the entire rest of the world, and you can go fuck around for a while if you want to. Put another 20 hours in if you wish. Put a pin in the main quest. And I'm like, well, it doesn't feel good to do that to me. Like, I, you know, so it, the way that they did it was strange. And I think that I would have appreciated having at least the option to do more optional stuff in Act 1 and Act 2. Maybe I missed it. Maybe there was more, but it felt to me like I wasn't made aware of much, and that was kind of an issue to me. It felt very backloaded in terms of the extra content that would have maybe helped me warm up to Verso or helped me become more of a team player, I think. Somebody was telling me that in addition to the building of relationships in the camp, that there's more to that. Like, each of those people has a quest. I didn't see any of those quests. Like, it must have been in Act 3 or something where it's like, I did as much as I could do, and then by the time I got, I'm a stone's throw from rolling credits. Why would I go do 20 hours of other stuff at that point, you know? So, yeah. I mean, well, what are you guys' thoughts on that?
I'm with you to a point, but then I was also, I had to kind of take myself away from the story a bit and just forget it. And it was like, right, okay, so let's just enjoy my time in this world that they've crafted and just explore kind of everywhere. So the relationship stuff you mentioned about having specific quests for each character, I wasn't a massive fan about how they introduced the relationship stuff, because it was just like, you just happen to go to camp and you have to like just round robin everybody and just speak to them all once. And then you go back into overworld again and you round robin again, you'd have a prompt to speak to them and you'd have a cutscene and they would like, then in, it would progress their relationship status. And essentially it did, the way it worked with that one is once you got to, I think, a seven or eight, it would give you an actual mission. So rather than just being a cutscene where you chatted to them, it would take you to another location to progress and finalize their story, I guess. And then when you got to that point, you unlocked the, what were they called, gradient moves or something?
Gradient moves,
So your only way to unlock those gradient moves was to basically enhance the relationship with each member of the party, which included like SKA, who wasn't a playable character as part of your party, but then also like Monoko, Luna, CL, and Mayal. But then I think the reason I had a point with them, an issue with them with Act 2 is because, as Brad said, it just piles everything in. It kind of gets things going. You want to get the story rolling and you want that momentum to kind of carry on. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, you're at the monolith now and we can get through the monolith. And throughout the entire game, the goal has been like to get to Paintress, to get to the monolith. And you get to that point, you kind of go, and the gamer in you goes, should I stop and look around a bit more now then? Because this is probably going to be the end, like run through as it were.
Exactly.
And it is like, oh, it's like, well, I don't, because I'm kind of like, I want to see the story progress, but I also want to know that I know there's other stuff I missed because I've flown past it while exploring the overworld kind of stuff. I did like the way in which it did that. And I played it in as much as I kind of progressed to Act 3, did some exploring, pushed to Act 3, and then went back without starting a new game plus to explore the overworld, the other stuff.
Right.
I don't know if it was the intention for some people to do it that way, but some of the stuff you come across feels as if that's the way to have done it.
Right.
Because the challenge it puts in front of you, like there's some kind of like secret characters, I guess, boss fights you can do.
Yeah.
There's a guy called Simon in there that's like notoriously super difficult. As part of it. And you kind of only find him really after you do Act 3. You're not really near leveled enough before you get to like return to Lumiere. There's like an endless tower thing where you go up a level and each fight gradually gets harder and harder and harder. And again, towards the end of that fight, if you haven't finished the game, it's almost spoilers because it introduces characters at the end of the tower that are like revealed as story beats as part of like Act 3 as well.
Right.
So I think they do have it positioned in a way that it does encourage you to go up. It doesn't encourage you to go back at the end of Act 3, but that's what they want you to do.
Yeah.
I think that's the biggest fault of it, is it doesn't push you or encourage you to kind of like push ahead in the story. You can do all this stuff after, it's okay, but let's keep the momentum going. If it pushed a bit more for that, I think it'd fit better and land better with me personally.
Yeah, fully agree. Like you have to be endgame to do some of that stuff and even grind past that. Even at my endgame status, I was nowhere near strong enough to fight some of those fights. But at that point, like I was like, it was like, it feels like the end of the game. Like it just, the pacing to me was too weird. And I think that maybe there's a split, because I knew there's a lot of people who just like being in the world like you, Kyle. I mean, a lot of people have said the same thing. And for me, I liked the story a lot. And so that was my main draw. And I wanted to do the story. And then once I was done with the story, I didn't have a lot of desire to go back, because I think there's a lot of meat in this game if you like fiddling with the pictos, like min-maxing and finding combos and synergies. And it gets like weirdly technical when you get to that, you know, like I was having people tell me that they would like have one character die in the first round and then that would buff the other characters.
Yeah.
And then that would do like a heavy hit. And people were telling me they were hitting for like 50 million or something like that. And I'm like, what the hell are you, what? So there's a weird min-max kind of part to it. I didn't care about any of that stuff. I didn't like any of that. It was fine, but that's not why I was here. I was here for the story.
Yeah.
And so I love what they're doing, but it felt like a little bit too untraditional in terms of pacing to me, especially with like the end game stuff that I just like, I felt like I only saw half the game, but at the same time, I didn't feel motivated to go and do that act 3 stuff, I guess. But that was just me.
Yeah. I mean, by the time act 3 came around, I was ready to finish the game.
Yeah.
I wasn't motivated to go back in and doing more unless I did another playthrough, which I might do. I don't know. We'll see. But, you know, by the time act 3 came around, and the big thing about Act 3 is you defeated the Paintress at the end of Act 2.
Yeah.
You know, and then the game's not quite over. And then you defeat Renoir at the end of Act 3. And it was revealed that the entire world is a painting.
Yes.
That's the big reveal, which I didn't really click into that it was a painting. I knew that there was something not right with the world, but it wasn't in my idea that it was this like magical inhabited painted world. My theory was that the number represented the amount of times that the painting had been painted over, like erased and painted over, which didn't turn out to be true. But that was my theory. It's like, oh, they've been erased.
That's a solid theory. That's a good theory.
Yeah, that's what I thought, but that wasn't true. So
it didn't go into much to dispel that either, though, Matt. That's the problem. Is the game wasn't very clear in the number thing. I mean, I do understand it was a link with like Eileen. Is it Eileen? I think it was the mother of the family, possibly Eileen or Eileen.
Yeah. The amount of years that Renoir's been trying to break her out of the painting, wasn't it? I think that's what
I think so. That every year she gets weaker because he's fighting through, so she can only. I think it was like she was controlling the people in the world and she only had enough power to keep them alive because she painted them. And every year went, she got weaker and weaker and weaker, which meant less inhabitants could be in the world. So that's why people were going at the age because there's less and less and less people.
Yeah.
I think that's what my understanding of it is. I could be completely off there. And again, it didn't do a very clear job of spelling that out for you.
They didn't.
Yeah.
I totally agree. And like, that's the funny thing is because if you go back and watch the trailer, they feature the number really prominently. That's like the big hook is like, what's going on with this number? And I think everybody who plays the game found that to be one of the biggest elements to be a mystery to be solved. Right. And I feel like they kind of punted on it at the end. I feel like it was very vague and mushy. Like you were saying, Kyle, it was like, the lady only has so much energy, but then why would you enumerate it like that? And then it was like a very distinct, I mean, just, it was like, look, let's just be real for a second. Okay. You guys thought that was a badass idea. And I agree. It was a great idea. You didn't really flesh that out. You had nowhere to go with that. You're like, whatever. Don't worry about it. Don't look behind the curtain. It's fine. I feel like that one didn't land for me.
I mean, I think we need to talk about that. Verso is Renoir and the Paintress's son.
Yeah.
And
Kind of. So if we're going to go in the complex this one, so like there's two Renoirs and there were two Versos.
Yes. You're in the fight with the Paintress, at one point near the end, she starts healing you, and that's because she's Verso's mum and she doesn't actually want you to die as Verso. So you're still hitting her and she's on the floor and she's healing you.
Yeah, but I think the important thing with that context is the fact that the Verso you're playing at isn't the real Verso. It's the Verso that the mum created following the death of the real Verso in like the outside painting world.
Yes.
And I think that was important that I mentioned the fact, because I forgot that fact where she starts healing you. That's a really important element to the fight because she never wants to let go. That's the whole point of this painting existing and Renoir fighting is their grief. Losing Verso because it's Verso's painting, it's all things created by Verso, it's elements of Verso's inverted commas soul within the things he created, and they just couldn't get rid of it. And again, it's that underpinning story beats about grief and how people deal with the loss of a loved one as well.
The whole thing about grief really
that brings you to the ultimate choice at the end of the game where as Verso, you can erase the painting and break free of it and effectively die. Mm-hmm. That version of Verso and release Mayo back into the real world. That's one of the choices. And the other choice is you fight Verso as Mayo and carry on with the painting and keep him inside the painting.
Yeah.
Well, I chose the latter choice. Actually, I wanted to see what it would be like to just carry on in that world with Verso unwillingly being in that world. I see you shaking your head, Kyle. I wanted to play that version because I kind of knew that would be the quote-unquote bad ending. And I wanted to see how it played out. And having made that choice, I probably would have made the other choice, to be honest. It really depends on your perspective at the end of the game, but I don't regret the choice because I played through it, and at that point in time, I felt it was the right one for me. But if I played through it again, I probably would choose Verso to basically obliterate the painting.
Yeah, because you eventually learn that Mayo isn't actually called Mayo in the real world. She's got a different name. Is it Alicia?
Alicia, yeah.
And in the same fire, because you've got the painters and the writers of these two different clans, and I'll come back to this a bit in the alternative theories bit if we have time to touch on that right at the end. But the real Verso dies in the fire that Alicia gets disfigured in and can't speak anymore now in the real world. And that's why she wants to stay inside the painting as Mayel, because in the painting, she's not disfigured. She's not lost her voice.
Yeah, she's a real person, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's that almost like sci-fi virtual reality trope, isn't it? If you're living that second life in a virtual world, it's just materialized through a painting rather than a headset in the Matrix. You know what I mean? It's essentially it's like the painted version of the Matrix, basically.
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So just since we're talking about the ending, can we all go through who we all chose and what did we think about what the choice we made?
Well, I've said mine.
I'll go next then. I chose Mael. Mm-hmm. But I agonized on it. I stood at that screen for like 5 minutes thinking about what my choices were. Wow. And I'll tell you why I chose Mael. We haven't really touched on this very much, but the game spends a lot of time talking about Mael, because she is like disfigured, and you can see pretty clearly that when the disfigured version of her shows up, it's like the same person, but the hair is slightly different and she's disfigured, but you're like, that's obviously Mael. Like it can't really be anybody else. Mm-hmm. And so an element of this whole game to me is the end. My wife and I talk about this a lot. Well, like we kind of like compared it to like kind of like a heroin addiction, because Renoir shows up, he wants to get his family out because they're in the painting for too long. They're going to lose their minds. They're going to die. He wants to save his family. And that's really the ultimate reveal, is like, the guy you've been fighting against the entire game turns out to be like quote unquote the good guy, because he's trying to save you guys from your own selves. And so from Renoir's perspective, he's like trying to save his heroin addicted daughter from going down the rabbit hole. He wants to get her clean, kind of get her out of the painting. But from the other perspective of it, Mael said she's very lonely. She's physically disfigured in the real world. She doesn't have any friends and she doesn't like her family. It's like a really negative experience. And so to me, in my mind, I was like, well, what's really the damage? I mean, if she wants to be in the painting and be happy and she feels like her body is back to normal and she's got friends that see, I mean, these painting people seem like real ass people to me. Like they don't, they're not like 2D stick figures or something like that. They seem like real people. Is there really a downside to her being in the painting? I didn't think so. And so after I saw all the endings, I went on YouTube, the other one, and I'm like, okay, I get a fuller vision of it now. But at the time, for me anyway, I didn't really feel like they spent a lot of time fully explaining why it was bad to stay in the painting. I was like, okay, sure, it's bad. Okay, but why? And you see it in the ending, of course. And then I'm like, well, shit, I wish I chose the other one. I didn't know. But from my perspective, I chose it because it seemed like Maya was making an informed choice about how she wanted to live the rest of her life. And I wanted to respect that she could make her own choice. And I kind of just chose it for that reason, I guess.
Yeah, I'd agree. Similar motivations that I had at the time. But like you say, when you get to the end and you see the other ending, it's like, fuck.
pretty much
yeah, see, I'm the black sheep in the group of the room, because I was with Verso and I was stuck at that point and kind of mulling it over, thinking, okay, which one do I want to do? And it wasn't like, which ending do I want to see? It was more, which makes the most sense to how I'm feeling about after playing this game. And I think for me, I was very much in the camp Verso, because I seen throughout what he'd been through, who he was. Like, he wasn't the real, he knew he was a painted version. He knew he wasn't the real Verso. And he, and I think a lot of it was the pain that you saw in Verso throughout the game, because he was always there seeing these expeditions come and go and come and go and die, and he was left. And there's some frivolity that's done with that. I think there's a really interesting, quite interesting story. It says in one of them where they discover that there's something about him from a past expedition, and
he
gets cut in half.
Yeah,
and all of a sudden he's back again.
Mm.
And they're kind of like, well, what's going on there? And then I think him and Monoko turn it into a party trick. Like, he gets cut. I think I can't remember whether it was in the game or it was one of the relationship things, but Monoko cuts him in half. And he goes and sees the party in the camp, and there's this big, what the hell's going on? What's going on? And they laugh it off. And he's like, oh, it's at the party trick now because he can be cut out because he's not real.
That must have been the relationship thing, because I don't remember seeing that in the
game. I didn't see it either, but I heard about it,
Yeah, so I was very much Verso, and I think I was, when I played through it and I got that point, I felt vindicated personally in that choice that I made. Like, I felt as if she needed to let go. And I mean, just how I felt personally, life experiences and my experience of the grief and all that kind of thing, it touched a note with me a little bit about how you need to, if moving on is healthy. And I felt a little bit with my L thing is like what she was getting into and the way she was going was as an unhealthy way to deal with where she was. I understood that it was a really shitty situation she was in the real world, in inverted commas. Mm-hmm. Because she was disfigured, she could talk, her family was in fighting and this whole thing going on around it.
Yeah.
But then I think the justification in it was that we're at the end of it, there's the scene where they're all around Verso's grave.
Yeah.
And the family comes together again
mm-hmm.
after that. And I was like, well, that's what I wanted. I wanted the family to kind of to come close again and not have this almost like drug-like addiction to the painting, as Brad referenced. So that's where I went with it, and I was like, okay. And again, I did the same. I went back and YouTubed the other ending, and I was like, yeah, I didn't do that one. Seeing everyone walk into the little the opera house, and then Verso playing the piano when he's outside. Most, I'm like,
I felt kind of tricked, though. Honestly, I felt like they kind of pulled the rug out for me, because I felt so much for Mael, and I was like, it seemed to me to be about assuaging her grief, right? But then when you get to the ending of Mael, she becomes kind of like crazed, and she kind of is kind of mean to Verso by making him play the piano. I'm like, well, that's not what I signed up for.
No.
That's not what I thought I was going to get with this. This is not fair. So,
yeah, but I think it's fair to say, because we kind of cover quite a lot, is like we've been quite the heavy topics within the game, and that the game itself does cover a lot of heavy topics, things like grief and loss and family and all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. There was a fair amount of comic relief through the game as well in places, though. And that's where I think it's pretty good to introduce like the like of Estier and Monoko and the Gestrals. We haven't hardly touched upon the Gestrals as a group of NPCs you kind of come across. But they were very much like the comic relief through all of it.
Definitely. Like
and it all, at first when you do it, it's, oh, you're very funny, all comic relief and blah, blah, blah. And then when you learn that everything in this painting is the product of child Verso.
Yeah.
It makes sense of their, like, how they behave and, like, how Eskier engages. Eskier is this big, lovable character, and he's always is the big outlook. He's, like, always optimistic, and he's looking out for Verso, and he's offering hugs to everybody. And it's, like, what you would probably need if you were a child making something and you needed that comfort. It's the type of character you would create. Mm-hmm. Monoko is like the ultimate bro, you know, and that it's like that companion, and that's where that comes in as a standalone gesture. Like I loved those two to the point where I'm getting a tattoo of both Monoko and Eskie in like 2 weeks time.
Oh, nice. You have to send us the picture of that. That's hardcore.
Yeah, I'll send it over. So I've spoken to my artist and got that sorted, but I absolutely loved both those characters. I mean, I can't show it now because it's going to be dark here, but I went to a paint yourself pottery thing with my family about a month ago, and I've got a tile about this big that's on my face of I painted SKA's face.
Oh, nice.
With a big like we and then woo underneath, and it's like all this kind of things that stuck with me after the game was played. But I like the introduction of those characters as a lightener, because it is a very dark and heavy game.
Yeah.
I
gotta admit, I didn't enjoy the Gestrals at all. they wound me the fuck up, like anything I could to avoid any interaction with them, because I did not like their design. I did not like the interaction. I did not like the way they talked. So I avoided them as much as I could possibly could.
Mainly,
like, you know, I just, I, after that first interaction with them, I'm like, no. it just annoyed me. I didn't want to be annoyed by the game. I don't know. Maybe I played too many games, but I just found it annoying. But you're right. It is from a childlike perspective. So
yeah,
I'd agree with that. But even so, it just annoyed the fuck out of me.
Why would you up?
Yeah,
I was kind of in the middle. I thought they were okay. I really liked Eskie and Minoko a lot. The gestures themselves, I was like, yeah, okay, fine, like whatever, they're fine, that, you know, whatever. But I will say, I'm a little embarrassed, because when you finally meet Minoko, he's got like a backpack on, and it looks like he's got like firewood or something in there.
Yeah,
it was like third quarter of the game, and I'm like, oh, it's the legs that he collects. He's got a backpack full of legs. Is that what that is? I was like, oh, I was like. Is he a woodsman? Yeah. What the fuck is going on? Why does he got these sticks on his back? I do not get it. Like, I guess if there was like more feet sticking off, like it would have maybe more of a clue. But all of the enemies' feet, they'll kind of go into like a little point. So when you cut off their legs, it just looks like a stick. I was very confused. By that. I'm embarrassed.
I just thought it was a backpack. I didn't even look at it that closely, to be fair.
Right. My favorite funny moment was where I think you needed a password at some point. And Gustav got told to shout the password as loud as he could. I can't remember, was it like, get the fuck out of the way or something like that?
Something like that.
And so he goes and shouts the password, and then the guests were like, rude.
To be so mean about it.
They have to hurt my feelings. Yeah.
Go through.
Well, we've talked a fair bit about the story. I just want to talk a little bit about the gameplay. It is obviously turn-based. And what I found, I don't know if you guys found the same, but it wasn't until, because I was struggling with the parrying a little bit just because of the timings, until they released that patch and made it a little bit easier. But what I found was, when you come across a first type of enemy, like when you've never encountered an enemy before, you know, just the grunts, not talking about bosses, you use dodge rather than parry. So you can practice the timing. Mm-hmm. That helped a lot when I, you know, the first few encounters when you're an enemy, and I was able to parry like 90% of the time, maybe. But it's when they pull out the different patterns on you that you've not experienced before. And I was like, that kind of threw me a little bit, because, I mean, this game's all about parrying. That's where the damage comes in. Brad, you were talking about like 50 million damage. It's got to be through parries, because that's what this game wants you to do. Either wants you to parry or use those really big attacks.
The gradient
attacks. But I did enjoy the gameplay. I think the gameplay actually is the outstanding part, other than the music, for me, for the game. The story was really good, but the gameplay is what got me hooked into the game. You know, being turn-based, you know, parrying, dodging. I think my main team was Mael, Minoko, and what's the name? Luna.
Element.
Yes, yeah, they were the main three that I used for like three quarters. Well, once you got Minoko, I just used him all the time.
Did you fiddle with the pictos and stuff? Did you like min-max and find all the combos and synergies and all that?
But I used them. I unlocked. I liked the ones that I liked, and I did look at them to maximize my damage or elements across the three characters. So I did a little bit, but not massively, because for me that seemed the best combination, especially when you can resurrect characters once they're fallen. That was a really good, useful thing to have, because some of those later enemies could like one hit you, so then you can resurrect and carry on. So that's what I kind of like, because I never very rarely actually use Verso, because once Gustav was gone, I'm like, I didn't use Verso hardly at all. And the other character, I can't remember her name, but those are the three. Yeah, those are the three ones that I use the most.
I mean, I played the entire game, and my wife, both of us played the entire game before the patch came out.
Right.
So when I read the notes, they said they increased the parry window by like 40%, which is huge. So we had the original.
Yeah, it was noticeable.
We had the teeny tiny little special, like impossible to hit parry windows. It was very difficult. I mean, I was hitting the parries maybe like half the time. Right. And usually like on the regular enemies, it would wind up with a normal wind up, and you could hit those. That's okay. But then they do the guy spinning around and he dodging and back and like all these weird timings. And it felt like I was playing friggin' one of the more, you know, irritating Dark Souls bosses or something that are designed to catch you out. And I didn't appreciate those at all. And the wife was like, I'm done with this. I'm just dodging. So I wish we had played it after the parry would have been adjusted. I think it was too tight and I didn't care for that a lot. Ate a lot of damage. I felt like I shouldn't have gotten, but whatever. I mean, a question for you, since we're talking about, we mentioned CL a second ago. I like CL as a character. Okay. I did not understand her powers like at all. And I just like ended up not, did any of you guys use CL? She was like too complicated for me or something.
I did only because I had to. So a part of my quest to get the platinum trophy on PlayStation is each character has a certain like signature thing they can achieve. So CL's was all about loading in like cards on the character.
Yeah.
With like a debuff, and it was a flitting from day to twilight with her. So it was all that sort of leading into the tarot card stuff.
Yeah.
But CL was almost a support character to a point, because some of her skills were about buffing others in the party.
Yeah.
So there was a move you could do that would basically give like someone else in the party, next time they attack, they did like 200% damage. Or she would give them an extra move and you go through over to them. So like some of the meta setups using CL was about doing that. It was like you'd set certain things up, you get to CL, you would buff everybody, you would then give a character with a single one hit massive move damage number an extra 200% on top of it, and then they would do it and they basically wipe out an enemy in one move. I think that whether that's the way they intended to play her or not, I'm not too sure. But CL definitely felt as if she was a middle ground. She would never really do massive amounts of damage, but she was very much heavy in that support role within the party of the ones you could get.
Yeah.
By the end of the game, Mael was my highest damage by far.
Same.
Yeah, she had that move. Was it Stendhal, I think, the move that she had?
Yeah.
Because it was all about switching stances. You could put in a defensive stance or a virtuoso stance. And if you managed to... play the moves a certain way and you'd end in a virtual stance, when you went into Stendhal, that did like the extra 200% damage or something ridiculous.
Yeah.
So when like certain times when you're buffing, you could be doing like millions upon millions of damage with her single move. As for about gameplay, Verso is another one. So there was the shooting mechanic in there where you could shoot that would use the energy. I can't remember what it's called as well. That stuff. Yeah, whatever it's called. Yeah, so you'd use that, and that would be like what you could do moves, but you could also shoot with it, and enemies have weak points, and you could like do status effects and things on them. The meta was all about that, but Verso, you could have him set up. You basically turned to machine gun.
Yeah.
So you could like shoot. But it was like if you set a mark on an enemy or you set an enemy on fire, you get like AP back in response. Yeah. And it was procking so often, you get like 25 shots off in one fell swoop.
Oh, interesting. Fire
like a machine gun. And then once the enemy's marked, anyone else that attacked him later on will do more damage. It kind of all stacked. It was all about synergizing, really. But the way in which I generally did it is I would do that, and then Maya would just come in and just do like 10 million damage in one fell swoop.
Yeah, nice.
And she'd take everything out. But I didn't struggle with the parrying as much personally. But I'm the kind of person who was like, I love my rhythm action games. And there's an element of that to it. It's not quite as musical. There's not as much musicality with like the responses to parries. But there is certain, from the bigger enemies at least anyway, an element of rhythm to their attacks.
Yeah, certainly.
And I think once you tune into that rhythm, the parrying does a little bit easier. But I'm saying this, like I didn't play it on easy all the way through either. I had it cranked down to easy, but that was initially just because I'm not an RPG person. So I was like, I want to get through this game.
Yeah.
I don't want the turn-based combat to hold me back from experiencing the story and finishing it.
Yes.
And that's where I went. And it turns out in the end, it is one of my favorite things about it is the parrying. but I never had the guts to turn it up much more than easy mode.
Did anybody do any level grinding? I found about midway through Act 2, I spent about 2 or 3 hours grinding levels. Finding enemies, getting like another 3 or 4 levels up to get me past that boss to get to the next part. So I mean, most RPGs are level grinding. You know, Persona was one of them, and also Ni No Kuni spent dozens of hours level grinding in that. But this one only did it like maybe 2-3 hours of level grinding in Act 2 just to get past the post, basically.
Yeah, there was 2 Renoir fights in Act 2, and I found the first one much more difficult, so I had to grind a bit to get past that one. And then the second one, when you go back and you fight Renoir again, I was surprised how much easier I found it compared to the first time you fought him.
I didn't have to grind. I mean, maybe like a little bit, tiny bit. Not, I didn't intentionally say, well, today's my grinding day.
No.
It was just like maybe like I'll run around a couple times before a boss or something, maybe just go up one notch or something like that, but not a whole lot. Just to circle back for a second, it's interesting that there's so much complexity and depth to the combat system, even though that's not what I really like the game for. I really liked it for the story, but we all kind of have different stories about how we were playing. And even though I didn't like Verso as much as you did, Kyle, as a character, I ended up using him for almost the entire game after I had him. Yeah. And I had the weapon where he got to hit twice, and then there was like a picto that let him go again.
Yeah.
And I had it keyed up so that he was attacking like about 4 times per turn. So I didn't do the machine gun thing, but he was going like all the time. And so even though his damage wasn't that high, like the number of turns made up for it. So I appreciate there's a lot of depth to it. It's weird to me because I do feel like the game is kind of 2 halves. I feel like you've got this really well-crafted story, but then you've got this really like tech heavy, like geek out, super detailed combat. Didn't really mesh for me personally, but I appreciate that those halves are there.
I mean, I had the same as you, Brad. That was what I was doing with Verso, but also I had a thing where he would get his health back as well.
Yeah.
So you do like, you get like basically, like you said, 4 goes at a time, but then he's also getting his health back. So if you do get damaged, you're getting healed again. And then you could, as long as you keep him alive, you can keep Luna alive as well. And then you can use her as a healer for the whole team. And it all just sort of synergizes together.
That's basically what I was doing too. Yeah. Pretty much.
Yeah.
This, it was surprisingly deep. Because my end group was, which I think it had Lune, Mael, Verso, and CL were my final 4 when I kind of got towards the end. But I got to be honest, a lot of it was just like Lune, I was just using to do that. She does like a basically a nuclear explosion one where I think if you had all 4 elements in the wheel, you'd use that. And I had it set up in a way that if you just went once, it would automatically populate it and you'd almost guarantee to get 4. Right. So the next time she goes, she does. So I would, that would be how I'd use Lune and then the rest of it kind of thing. But it was surprisingly deep though. What I wasn't a massive fan of is to get the most out of that, you had to really explore to find pictos. And if you didn't know those pictos existed, you probably never see them and you never min-max your playthrough. It was only until I got to like the really, really hard stuff where there's a character I say called Simon, who's a notoriously hard boss fight.
Yeah.
Where I got to the point where like, okay, I need to find some stuff. So I ended up looking up builds specifically to kind of deal with him.
Yeah.
And then I spent some of the time on to look around maps trying to find random pictos that I missed in plain sight while running through the world that were so vitally important to this build that did like 20 million damage. If you didn't have a picto, it just wouldn't work. And it was, so whilst it was as in depth as it was, there was a lot to miss and you had to really pay attention to what you were picking up to be able to craft anything. Which I appreciate the depth, but again, that's not me. I'm not one of those people. I just went to YouTube and looked at the tutorial that talked me through it.
Well, to be fair to all of us, why did we miss those pictos? Because there's no freaking mini map. Freaking mini map.
It's true. One of the things that I noticed towards the end of the game, I'd mentioned this to Jeremy, I don't think he found it as irritating as I did, but it's a slight criticism of the game, was the cinematics towards the end, the mouth movement and the talking just didn't mash up for me. I don't know whether it was on PS5 or just my copy of it or what, but it was very distracting. The last like 3 hours of the game, the cinematics, it was out of sync. And it really... it took me out of the experience. No, it might have just been my copy of it. I don't know.
I experienced that as well, and it made me wonder whether if you play it in French, it would be better, but it doesn't match up as well for the English.
Yeah, it was distracting. It's distracting enough for me to like say this is annoying the fuck out of me. I'm, you know, I want the cinematics to be good, but it was out of sync, and I'm like, I don't know. But it's only a slight criticism, really.
I didn't notice that in my playthrough.
No,
so I didn't get that either from it. But there's a really good segue into, while we sort of like towards the end of the tying this things up, for the voice cast. Phenomenal voice cast. Really, really exceptional voice cast. I mean, you've got the Charlie Cox, as you mentioned, was Gustav. And then you've got Jennifer English, who's done some really heavy hitting RPGs recently, notably what was her name in Baldur's Gate? I didn't play Baldur's Gate 3, but she was Ironheart, I think, was one of the main characters in that one. Ben Starr.
Yeah,
recently was Clive in the most recent Final Fantasy, was Verso. You've got what's his face? Andy Serkis was voicing Renoir.
Oh, yeah.
A stellar voice cast in it. And I genuinely did come across. I mean, I am a bit disappointed for you, Matt and Jay, really, that like the syncing put you off.
It could detract
a little bit from like the really, really good delivery of the voice cast in there. But that's definitely one of their strengths, was like the quality of the voiceovers and the voice cast that was part of the game.
I fully agree. And you know, just to support that, I mean, I 100% I fully agree. But this is one of the first games in recent memory where I feel like they communicated a lot through just body language and facial expressions, which is really a tough trick to do in video games. Mm-hmm. But there were many cutscenes where, you know, Mael would look over and she would just like raise an eyebrow, or like Lune would give like a tilt of the head, and that combined with the strong voice performance was really emotive. I mean, I really felt like a lot for these characters, and sometimes they were using silence in a really productive way where it's not just two characters sitting there not talking, but like the silence meant something. Somebody said something and then there's like a long pause. You can clearly feel like they're thinking about it, or maybe they're feeling a feeling. And I feel like the cutscene director, whoever that was, really did a killer job. And I think between the stellar voice acting and the amazing art direction and voice cutscene direction, it really bumped the entire game up like several notches for me. And that's really why I got so invested in the story. Like I felt something for them, like on a legitimate level, pretty quickly in a way that I don't often feel. Not the same thing as like watching a bonkers Metal Gear cutscene or some low rent cutscene that just takes you from level to level. Like it really, for me, like that was really where the juice was. And I really appreciated those quiet moments and the small moments. That really was like the difference between a good game and like a great game for me.
Yeah. I mean, one other thing is that, as well as the voice cast, was the music, I thought was excellent. Very, very well done.
I mean, soundtrack of the year, maybe? I feel like it's got to be.
It's definitely up there. It's definitely up there. I mean, it was combination of orchestral and vocal, wasn't it? So it was. It really set the mood for the game, that opening track, you know, and throughout the game, you know, just stood there for a few minutes just listening to the music. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The sign of an excellent soundtrack. Yeah.
Really good. Briefly, because I know we're going to lose Brad shortly, I wanted to talk about alternative theories. And I heard this one that Verso, the one we were playing, isn't actually the dead one. That this theory is that Verso's faked his death because he wanted to leave the painters and defect to the writers. Because he's a musician, he feels more aligned with the writers and feels the only way he can defect over to their side is to, you know, fake his own death. And then so he escapes into the painting as the real one, and so you're actually playing the real one after all, and the family is all grieving his death, but he's not actually died. I mean, it's a bit of a flawed theory, but quite interesting all the same.
Well, if you choose Verso at the end, then that doesn't make sense to me.
No.
He obliterates himself.
He wants to die. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. I don't know. I didn't follow into too much because, like I said to you before at the start, I didn't go down the rabbit hole once I'd finished the game.
Right.
I was comfortable with my experience and the way I delivered the story enough to not need to kind of go digging for some other fan theory or something else. I was really satisfied with the conclusion. I can see how there is a lot of speculation to it, because it's one of those games. There's a lot open to interpretation through some of it, probably by design. But I never personally thought I need to kind of dig back deeper into it. I just liked my experience. I enjoyed the story. And I think once I'd finished the story, and I was in that point where I was looking for trophies to get the platinum, I was playing it more as a video game rather than a story experience. So I was going through the usual video game stuff. Okay, where can I get the most XP from this location to grind up to get to level 100 for this trophy? What about this one? I mean, there was some extra experiences that I got from doing that. Like, it took me to all the Jeshful beaches with little mini games and stuff that were part of the trophies, which you could have easily have missed. And not, because all you got is costumes from it.
Yeah, I missed them all. They're platforming, aren't they?
Not all, some of them. Some of them. Mm-hmm. It's like, I can't remember what it's called. It's like some platformy, towery thing that was big on PC where you climb up and go up and up and up was one of them. One of them was like a volley game. Another one was climbing up the wall. Yeah, stuff like that. And they're all mini-game distractions, and they very much fit with the whole gestural ethos of, like, this world is going to shit, but we're just having to chill out on a beach and having a fun game. It was very much in that vibe. But there's a lot to explore. I did find an awful lot by playing it as a video game and doing it to grind the stuff out. I did find a lot of extra stuff. I was like, oh, okay, that did enhance it and add a bit of flavor. But I did like all the little costumes and things you can get, and you can change your lineup, and you look for the mimes, and you could dress everyone up as a mime, and Gustav or Verso's got a baguette on his back, and all that kind of, that kind of stuff. I appreciate all that kind of little touches, but again, it didn't push you down that route when you're playing. It was like, once you've played and you've enjoyed the story, if you're in so way inclined, now we're going to have an explore and find all this really cool stuff in our world.
Yeah,
for sure.
Like, I can't know which ending is in, but SK is like a plushie in one of the endings, isn't he?
You find him. So in the manor house, not even the ending, if you find all the doors throughout the world to open all the doors in the manor,
right,
you find Verso's room, and SK is on the bed in Verso's room as like a plushie figure.
Right. Cool.
And again, you are on with the house thing, Noko and Monoko were the family dogs. And there's a room you can find in the manor that is just full of paintings of what is actually the real dog, which is part of the development team, called Monoko. And you see then the family room with the dog basket with Monoko and Noko, who is like the father and like the child.
The
dog and the puppy kind of thing. So it felt it did a good job of those parallels, where if you looked for it, you could find the parallels between, like, okay, this whole thing of it being a painting and here's the real world parallel. It did signpost some of that, but yeah, for all of its strengths, there were some weaknesses, but I thoroughly enjoyed it from start to finish.
For sure. Definitely one of the stronger experiences of this year. I mean, we're only halfway through the year, give or take. And so, you know, I'm always, as a game critic and podcaster, I'm always looking towards December, game of the year, what's the top 10 going to be? And I think this one will absolutely be in my top 10 for sure. I don't know that it's going to take the top slot, but it's certainly, like, you know, one of the strongest experiences. And it's strong to the point that I even felt comfortable recommending it to people who don't normally play these games. My wife is not a turn-based person at all. She's like platforming, Dark Souls, action, stop talking, let me kill something. That's what my wife is at, and I love her for it. But it was such a good experience. I thought she would like it, and she did. She loved it. So I think it's something that a lot of people could connect with, even if you're not an RPG or a turn-based. But I think there's enough meat in these bones, story-wise, character development-wise, music-wise, that anybody can probably find something to like about it.
Yeah, I think so.
But like I said, if anyone is interested in going into it, definitely look into some videos and stuff for gameplay. If you're not a turn-based person, definitely try it out. It seems to be it's a really good experience to miss up on, I think. It's worth a go. And if you find yourself not getting into it and you can't, I understand that, because again, not all games are built for everybody. But do yourself a favor and just look into it. Look up some gameplay stuff, look up some maybe some streamers playing it. And then one final thing I would say is, if you do find yourself invested in it, definitely go down the rabbit hole and look over its development. Really interesting story involved in that, which we haven't got time to go into in the podcast today, but it's a fascinating story about how the studio developed, where it come from, where all these people come from. It's like the A-team of, like, video game development, just pulled people from all different places. It just seemed to work. There was sort of lightning in a bottle for them, and I think that does come through in the final game. It's that lightning in a bottle. So whilst I am excited for what the studio does come up with next, I'm a bit trepidant just to see if they can capture that same magic that they got with
Yeah. I heard they were working on a Match 3 mobile game. Is that not correct?
Guess we'll find out soon, won't we?
Yeah. All right, in-app purchases.
I think we've got to say goodbye to Brad because he's got to go. He's got to vacate his space that he's using at the moment. So thanks for coming on, Brad, and chatting with us on Clay Obscura Exhibition 33. It was good to hear your viewpoints. And we'll look forward to seeing you in a future podcast, hopefully.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you guys all for having me back on. It's always a pleasure, and I'm happy that we were able to make it work. We have a big time difference between America and UK. It's like the middle of the day, but I'm glad it all came together, and it was a pleasure to talk to all you guys, and great to see you all.
Yeah, you too.
Thanks, Brad. You too. Have a good one.
All right. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye.
Bye.
Cool.
Yeah, he's done.
I don't know if you want to carry on talking a little bit more about it, or whether we've got any
more things. We covered things quite extensively, I feel.
We've mentioned gameplay, cinematics, voice acting. I haven't really got much else to say about it, really, I don't think.
I pretty much covered everything.
Yeah, I mean, overall, I think I'd probably give it a solid, I would say, 9 out of 10 if I was scoring it, I think. You know, not a 10 out of 10 for me is, you know, exceptional. Yeah. You know, I think a 9 out of 10 is fair. And I think the reviews that it got were probably between 8s and 9s.
They were high. They were very high, yeah. It didn't lead itself in expectation-wise either, because it was a kind of unknown studio.
Yeah,
it didn't have that prerequisite of, okay, this should be good, so therefore the score is going to reflect, or if it's not meeting expectations, the score is going to take a hit because of it. It genuinely got the scores from its own merit, from how good genuinely the game was, which I really appreciated. But it's what I went in for, you know. I went in expecting something phenomenal, and that's what I got out of it. I love games like this.
Yeah, if you've got an Xbox and it's on Game Pass, I'd say definitely play it. You know, it's a shame there's no demo version of it on PlayStation. There isn't, unfortunately.
No, and the physical version is hard to get a hold of on PlayStation as well, bizarrely.
That's weird.
You'd have to go. I mean, it might be okay now, but when I came to try and buy it, my only option was to go online from a few retailers to get it. I couldn't get it on the high street.
Oh, wow.
I had to. And yeah, in the end, I just bought PlayStation credit and bought it digitally. I was like,
that's what
I'm a lazy man. I don't want a disc. Just give me it digitally.
That's what I'm going to do. Donkey Kong Bonanza. I'm going to buy that digitally because I just can't be arsed with a cartridge.
That's just the way Nintendo are going with the Switch 2.
Yeah, they want you to do it that way. They want it.
But no, I mean, there's still a lot to talk about it. And again, I think with the music, you're grateful enough to have me on with the music discussion. I could chat and wax lyrical about this game the same as I could with music all night long.
Mm.
But I think what I would say is I would stress for somebody who's just vaguely interested in games in general, or even interested in games as an art form, or just like really entertaining experiences, to look into it.
Yeah.
Give it a go. And even if you go like the gameplay is not going to be for me, I don't like turn-based. Spend some time and spoil it for yourself and watching videos online then, you know, at least take in some of what it does. And that might be enough to kind of go, you know what? Yeah, the next game, I'm invested for that. I'm excited for that. And you might jump in the next one, which you might miss.
Yeah, absolutely. The good thing about this turn-based one is although it was turn-based, it wasn't your traditional turn-based because of the parry and the dodge.
It's active turn-based.
That's what made the difference for somebody who didn't normally play turn-based like you two don't normally. It was because I played a fair amount of turn-based games, and it's literally take your turn and then you can't take your turn again until X amount of time.
Just wait until the computer's done.
Yeah, so this one, they let you kind of muck around with that. So, and introducing the pictos and that kind of thing was really a clever design decision.
The one thing, I mean, my biggest gripe with turn-based stuff is how punishing they can be sometimes.
That's what makes it wrong. Not so easy, because it was really hard on normal.
I mean, you can make a decision on a turn-based stuff for do the wrong move, and then 10 moves later you die because of it.
Yeah.
And you've invested 20 minutes in that fight that's at the mercy of a decision you made 10 minutes ago. And it's like, that doesn't vibe with me. But this felt as if whilst it was punishing, because if you missed the parries and that kind of thing, you did get punished for it.
Yeah.
You could actively get involved. So there was an element of skill.
Yeah. Yeah,
so it, it, it,
was, like you mentioned before, what if you got into the rhythm of an enemy, you could really do the parries and the dodges. You had to figure out the rhythm in your head, which was very clever. I did like that aspect of it. I didn't really get a handle on it until about halfway through the game, I would say. Yeah, about halfway when I went to do the grinding in the middle of Act Two. Probably didn't need to grind, but I felt, you know, this is an RPG. I've got to do some grinding kind of thing. That was my mentality. It's an RPG. I have to grind levels. It's just a thing that you do. I did it with Witcher, did it with Persona, did it with all of them. So you probably didn't need to do that, but I felt like I needed to do just take on some enemies that I was actively avoiding on the open world. I'm like, I'm going to go and fight this enemy. And I did find one like giant enemy. It was a huge giant thing. And I'm like, am I leveled up enough? And I killed it first time. I was like, oh. And it gave me some good rewards. Yeah. So the game doesn't really explicitly say, you know, if you go and fight this enemy, you're going to get good rewards. You have to find that out. So I'm sure you did that.
The one thing it does do is, because of the overall work, you go into each instances in each zone. There were some times, you might not notice it, to be honest, but there were areas that had warnings on them. So if you went to go in, there's like a red exclamation mark next to the name when you go in. And that kind of said, look, go in at your own risk, at your own peril, because you're probably going to get stomped on because of the level you are. But even then, though, with enough determination, you could be like really low level and still win, because you just parry everything and dodge everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And just chip and grind and chip and grind. You can get through pretty much any fight by doing that. Mm. Which I think is that element of skill involved, as well as an understanding of the game mechanics and the pictos and the synergies that you can ascertain, that kind of stuff.
I think the most annoying debuff in the game is either the one that put you to sleep or the one that made you fight your own team.
Your own team, yeah.
I was like, nah.
There was one in there that it like reversed you. So if you healed yourself, it would kill you.
Yes. Yeah, the damage instead is really annoying.
Yeah, but bizarrely, that's part of like some of the metas.
Yeah.
So there's a picto that automatically puts you in that state, which means you do more damage.
And that's inverted, isn't it?
That's it. Yeah, that's the one. But it's like that picto that kills you when you start your turn. It just automatically kills you when you start your turn.
What's the idea behind that? I don't understand.
Go on, dude. You can explain. Go for it.
I was going to say one team member gets killed literally at the start of the turn, which then super buffs the remaining members of your team. And then you use one of your revives to bring the dead person back in again.
Right. So it's like a super buff, but one of them has to die. Okay. Yeah. Or released, be knocked out, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Effectively, you'd have the picto set up. Like, I think there's a bunch of them that, like, on character death, debuff the enemy or mark the enemy.
Yeah.
On character death, buff this one. On character debuff.
Yeah.
You have everything set up. So as soon as you spawned in, your character immediately died and then auto revive, because you've got that picture that like it allows you to revive, and all of a sudden you're doing like 500 times damage than you were before, and the enemy's been debuffed to oblivion because of it, which made some fights super trivial. But again, I enjoyed it. I like that power trip a little bit. You know, it's like that when you start going through it, you start building and getting stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger, to the point where towards the end I probably was a bit over leveled as well.
Yeah.
But I was like just blasting through everything. And I liked that, because I'd spent so much time dicking around before Act 3. By the time I got to Lumiere to kind of like finish the story, I just wanted to get through it.
Yeah.
I didn't want to have these long, prolonged battles and fighting those enemies, because I was like I just steamrolled everything and got the conclusion, which is kind of what I was looking for.
I mean, just before we wrap up, briefly going back to the music, the main composer guy, Lorien Testard, they plucked him from SoundCloud.
Could it be any more French, that name?
Yeah.
No. But the fact that he'd never done a video game before, and they found him on SoundCloud and then got him in to do this game as his first ever game, and I presume it won't be his last one now.
No, it's a really good job. Yeah. Yeah, I really hope when they do the video game awards at the end of the year that it's in there.
Mm.
Not the video game, the be all end all, but you know, they make a big deal about it. So I'd like to see it in. I'd like to see it in the finals of that that kind of thing. But we'll see, I guess.
Yeah, I think it will be. I think it'll be featured quite prominently in a lot of like Game of the Year lists, just generally. It came out quite early on, I think, is the only disadvantage. So as long as people remember it when by the time we get to that point. But again, I remember when it first came out, it was banded around as per usual, like, this is Game of the Year material, this is a contender for the Game of the Year in February when it landed.
Yeah.
Was that long?
It was April, wasn't it?
Was it April or was it February?
Near the end of April.
Right.
There we go. Even so, not even halfway through the year at that point, 4 months in.
Yeah.
And people already talking about it. And again, we've had some big heavy hitters come in since like the what was it, Kingdom Come Deliverance? I haven't played it, but that was talked about and banned.
Yeah, around. I haven't played that original or the new one.
Death Stranding 2 now is getting good scores, good reviews.
It is good, but too many cutscenes, like the first game, it's too many.
Welcome to Kojima's game.
I know, man. I should be prepared for it.
The same person who did like the stupidly long hour, 2 hour cutscene at the end of Metal Gear 4 or whatever it was.
I should have mentally prepared myself for it. But when there's a cutscene of Sam getting into bed, and then there's a cutscene of Sam getting out of bed, and then there's a cutscene of Sam going from the bed to the shower, then there's another cutscene of him turning on the shower, then there's another cutscene of him having a shower, then there's another cutscene of him leaving. Do you know what I mean?
I think, and that's the one thing I found the first game, because I was really late to that one. We're kind of diverging a little bit from Entry Obscure, but I was the same. Like the first game, I came in a few people late to it, but that's the one thing I wish they had, just like get rid of it. I skip it. I've seen it once, if I didn't see Norman Reedus's bare ass in the shower for in a cutscene.
Yeah, right. Well, I think we should wrap up here, innit, because we've been talking quite a long. I'm not going to do the socials. So if you want to see our socials, they are in the link in the description if you want to see that. But thank you for listening to our spoiler cast. If you made it all the way to the end, props to you, because it's been quite a long one, but we've enjoyed talking about it. Yeah. We might do another one in the future if we all play the same game. Who knows?
Yeah.
So that's it for episode 24 of Two Guys, Three Consoles podcast. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much, Kyle. This will be for coming on.
Yes, thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Brad, as well. We'll mention that in the description. Thanks. I'll put a big banner on it saying spoiler cast, so nobody should be offended if they listen to it and they haven't played it.
Yeah, and if Terror Obscure isn't your thing, we'll be back to our normal scheduled episode from next week onwards.
Yeah, to episode 25. We can't believe we're on 25 episodes already, but we'll be back to the normal things that we do. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next podcast.
Yeah, thanks, everybody.
Cheers, bye.
Bye.
Bye.